material that was left over from last week. And then Jeff Allen over here will report on and lead a discussion on religious experience and religious knowledge, two of the pieces in a third collection. But I'll take the material from Healing and Creating in History. So are you ready? Are you ready to begin? Okay. So Healing and Creating in History. I find it interesting, the opening, like he devotes two or three pages to Bertrand Russell and Karl Popper. And for Bertrand Russell and many church people, the problem with the world is that human beings are smart but wicked. Whereas for Karl Popper, the problem is that human beings are good but stupid. And Lonergan, in a very Augustinian moment, agrees with both of them. Because we have, because of sin, there is both a darkening of our intellect and a weakening of our will or our desire. So we can be stupid, but ultimately the stupidity that causes problems is that of bias, or the neglect of our abilities. But he says diagnosis is one thing, the problem is healing, and then creating is something else. All right, he deals with creating first. Now, this was a new departure for him at the time, this paper, and it was published, you know, in a very unobtrusive way in papers from the Thomas More Institute in Montreal, which usually, you know, they reach a certain audience, but they're not widespread. But this one took off in the Lonergan community. It was three papers by Bernard Lonergan, three lectures that he had given at the Thomas More Institute in Montreal. But the main reason that it took off was because of this paper, because there's something in here that at the time was new, and that was the emphasis on the movement from above downwards. That it is spelled out here in some detail for the first time in his writing. Everything up to this point, in terms of the articulation of the subject, everything in his writing was from below upwards. From experience, through questioning to understanding, through further questioning to judgment, through further questioning to deliberation. Now, all of a sudden, we find there's a reverse movement. And it operates in a couple of ways. First of all, when we're born into a community, and that community affects us from the top down, it affects us, first of all, by the communication of values. Even before we've had a chance to reach the age of reason and question things, we are educated into the community from above downwards, and for better or for worse. And we are born into a family that either loves us or doesn't love us, and that is from above downwards. And so there's this elemental meaning that is communicated to us from above, in the sense of affecting, coming from without, all right, and in that sense from above, but not from our own imminently generated knowledge and decision, but rather it affects us from the community. So that's one way in which there's a movement from above, and the other way is the movement of grace, which itself is almost always mediated through the community. But it's a movement that affects us first at the topmost level of consciousness, then affects our values before it affects our knowledge. Okay, so, but anyway, he begins by the movement of creativity, creating. And he relates both of these to the issue of the economic system, which was what he was dealing with in his own work at the time that he delivered this paper. He started to teach at Boston College in 1975 and was scheduled, I think, after this lecture to teach his first course in economics, the first course he ever taught on his own economic theory. There's a course entitled Macroeconomics and the Dialectic of History. So the need for human creating is illustrated from the contemporary economic situation and the power of the multinational corporations. He had just finished reading Global Reach, a book that had quite an effect on his late thinking on economics, the book called Global Reach. The multinational corporations are built, he says, on long accepted principles, such as the maximization of profit and so on, but the principles are inadequate and suffer from radical oversight. And their rigorous application on a global scale is heading us for disaster. That's all laid out in detail in the book Global Reach. But the new system needed for our collective survival does not exist. And here we are 30 years later, and it still doesn't exist. I just saw today the ad for a movie called Why We Fight, and it's starting this weekend at the Carlton. It's a documentary. And it starts with President Eisenhower's warning about the multinational, about the military-industrial complex, a warning that he issued when even this is a Republican president, and a general. Before he became a politician, he was a five-star general in the Army and one of the leading generals in the Second World War, warning the United States against the military-industrial complex. And if we give in to this complex, we're going to be fighting wars for the rest of our existence. Because there's a whole pattern that's set up of needing to fight wars in order for some of these companies to survive. And so the movie traces what has happened since Eisenhower issued this warning and shows that it's a lot worse today than it was when he saw the possibility that we could be getting into this. It's interesting for a Republican military person to be warning the United States against the military-industrial complex, how the Republican Party has changed in Alaska, because the Republican Party is right caught up in the military-industrial complex today. All right. So when survival requires a system that doesn't exist, then the need for creating it is manifest. And so the need for creating is what... So what is creating? What is the creative process? Well, it comes from a generalization of his cognitional theory and intentionality analysis. It's a matter of insight to begin with, but not one insight, but many. And not isolated insights, but insights that coalesce, complement and correct one another, insights that are shared in a community, that influence the policies and programs of a group, that reveal shortcomings in their concrete results. They try something out and it doesn't quite work. Well, then you correct it. You give rise to further correcting insights, corrected policies, corrected programs, until gradually there is an accumulation into, for a time being anyway, an all-round, balanced, smoothly functioning system, which is what people wanted from the beginning, but they didn't know what it would be yet. And so it's trial and error leading to something that works. Now, obviously, it's only going to work for a certain amount of time because situations are going to change, the needs are going to change, and something new will have to be developed. Often, he says, this happens. It takes its rise from a creative minority in the society. It's heavily influenced in some of these categories by Toynbee's study of history, Toynbee's categories. He came to see that Toynbee was not so much a historian as he was a person who provided a set of useful categories for studying history. And one of the categories is the creative minority. That creative minorities are frequently the ones who are responsible for the creative breakthroughs in society. But the creative minority will not succeed until they manage to persuade the people that what they're onto is right. So there's a distinction then of insight from slogan. Today, it's very hard, I think, for instance, in the last election, which we just suffered in this country, where was insight being expressed in any of the political speeches? Slogan hearing all over the place. But where was there any genuine insight? In fact, who's been the last politician or statesperson that you're aware of who spoke from insight rather than slogans? In the United States, in my estimation, it was Adlai Stevenson, and that's a long time ago. That's over 50 years ago. A person who spoke from his understanding of situations and tried to communicate that and did not get into sloganeering. But he didn't win the election either. He ran twice to be president of the United States, but didn't win. Okay, but insight, rather than slogans, approaches the concrete. Insight is into concrete situations, and the good is never an abstraction. It's always concrete. So the whole point to the process of cumulative insight is that each insight is rendering the is regarding the concrete and rendering the concrete ever more accessible to us. The cumulative process is heading toward an ever fuller and ever more adequate view. If you add abstraction to abstraction, you never reach more than a heap of abstractions. But if you add insight to insight, you're moving to the mastery of all the eventualities and complications of a concrete situation. The problem is the flow of fresh insights can dry up. Challenges may continue, but responses now fail. A minority that was creative ceases to be creative and becomes merely dominant. Once people come into power, the power can corrupt. Why? Well, the ultimate answer is minds get closed. Insights can be implemented only if people's minds are open. The problems can be manifest. You've all been up against this in some situation, in a school or in a social organization or in a diocese or in a hospital, where the insights, they're clear to you what needs to be done, at least to get something started, but you can't find an open mind to listen to them because of bias. And then he goes into his analysis of the four biases, dramatic, individual, group, and general. But all such bias distorts the whole process of growth. And so I'm quoting here from 105 and 106. Increasingly, the situation becomes not the cumulative product of coherent and complementary insights, but the dump in which are heaped up the amorphous and incompatible products of all the biases of self-centered and short-sighted individuals and groups. An absurd situation. And finally, the more the objective situation becomes a mere dump, the less is there any possibility of human intelligence gathering from the situation anything more than a lengthy catalog of the aberrations and the follies of the past. As a diagnosis of terminal cancer denies any prospect of health restored, so a social dump is the end of fruitful insight and of the cumulative development that it can generate. There's nothing that can be done. In some situations, there's nothing that can be done. My theology and the dialectics of history, I go into this both in the terms of the personal values, where people reach the situation that there's nothing that can be done unless, and in social situations, or there's nothing that can be done unless, and the unless is the point of the healing. Unless there is something else besides human development from below upwards. If there is genuinely something that moves the other way in the life of the individual, if arrested development can be met by love, it can soften the biases and the hardness of heart and whatever else is brought on by a lack of love in a person's life and bring healing into that person's life gradually. And it moves from above, starting with the value of being loved and experiencing that and then letting that just sink into and influence one's horizon, one's meanings, what one holds to be true, and eventually one's very experience at the infrastructural level, feelings, the flow of sensations, memories, images, associations, and so on. And similarly within a society, and if there is some other word that can be spoken, I think of Martin Luther King speaking a word into his community that really was a word of grace to them, calling them out of the frustration and the disgust that their situation had brought them into, and opening up a new avenue to development. So, and as I say here, this is where Lonergan gives one of his earliest presentations of the other way, the development from above downwards. Just as the creative process, when unaccompanied by healing, is distorted and corrupted by bias, however, there is the problem of the healing process, when unaccompanied by creating from below, isn't going to really lead anywhere. So there's operative grace and then there's cooperative grace. Okay, there's operative grace, but it sets off human cooperation with it, and if we don't cooperate with it, it's not going to lead anywhere. And our cooperation then will lead to creativity, insight, new judgments, new decisions, and so on and so forth. But it's you got to have the both of them together. And this is the danger that I think is present in any religious system that will not take seriously the social sciences to give us an understanding of the social situation. Theology alone is not able to analyze social situations. It's able to bring one component to the analysis of social situations. And it's able to bring a critical voice to any social ideology. But it can't, as simply theology, as speaking from strictly Christian categories of grace and sin and Trinity and Christ and so on and so forth. That's not enough to change a social situation. There has to be the cooperation of theology and the social sciences, and it's the social sciences that will give the insights into the concrete things that need to be done in under certain situations. Otherwise, the healing process, when unaccompanied by creating, is a soul without a body. This is my problem with certain strands in theology today, the Bonaventurian, Augustinian, von Balthasarian, Ratzinger approach to theology up to this point. We'll see what he does as Pope, where there has not been the serious consideration of collaboration with the human sciences on the part of theology. And in the case of von Balthasar, for instance, I think he's brilliant on the special categories. But without psychology, sociology, and economics, it's a soul without a body. So in terms of the economic problem raised by the multinational corporations, what this means is that economic theorists have to provide, and this is what Lonergan is talking, was so serious about with his own economics that he was working on, have to provide a new and specific type of analysis that reveals how moral precepts have a basis in economic process. So it's not simply pay a fair wage. That's fine. But as a lot of the people that were saying at the time that Lonergan started his work in economics in the 1930s, I want to pay a fair wage, but if I do, I'm going to go broke. So this was one of the things that started him on the path of trying to understand economic process. So how moral precepts have a basis in economic process and so can be applied to it, I'll come back to that in a moment, but also that moral theology, has to provide specifically economic precepts. Moral theologians, at least some of them, have got to know economics. It's like what I said last week or a couple of weeks ago. Theologians should know at least one other human science besides theology, should be able to find their way around. They don't have to be the world's expert in it, but they should be able to read the literature and so on. So some moral theologians should know economics and should know good economics, to provide specifically economic precepts that arise out of the economic process itself and promote its proper functioning. Now, this was what he saw and envisioned for and hoped for his own economic theory. And I can't speak to a lot of the details of his economic theory, but I know that he maintains that he can show how we can diagnose when the profit that has come in from an economic venture has reached its limit, and anything beyond that must become a social dividend that is turned back into the economic process and is not morally acceptable as more further profit for the entrepreneur. And it's within the process itself that he claims to be able to show that. That there's a certain point. Obviously, some profit is legitimate, it's necessary, it's part of the functioning, but it reaches a point where it's not to be gone beyond for the sake of the individual, and anything above and beyond that should be turned, for the very sake of the economic process and its continuation, should be turned back into the process in some form. So that's the kind of thing that he's talking about. So again, when the system that is needed for our collective survival does not exist, then it is futile to excoriate what does exist while blissfully ignoring the task of constructing a technically viable economic system that can be put in its place. So in some ways he's letting us know here what he's hoping to be able to accomplish through his own work in economics. So all that is needed, and I put in that in quotation marks, and I love this. It comes out of, I think it's out of, it's not Toynbee, it's somebody else. William James. An interdisciplinary theory, what James said was what happens to a lot of really the great ideas is that first they're denounced as absurd, then they're admitted to be true but obvious and insignificant, and perhaps finally they're regarded as so important that their adversaries will claim that they themselves discovered it, which I love, and which is something that is actually happening with Lonergan's own work, that there were people who said, it's absurd, and then, of course, it's obvious experience, understand it. And now you see these little words that are coming in that you know that they're getting from Lonergan, and these are people who at one time excoriated him, but you see old people are talking about moral conversion, they're talking about the biases, they're using his language, and so on and so forth, as if this was their own discovery. So, anyway. It's a great comment about our willingness to learn from others. All right, that's all I'm going to say, and we'll take a few minutes, and then I want to give Jeff a chance to get started on his work. And Jeff, we'll just go till 3 and break, and wherever you are at that point, so... So anything that you want to throw into the hopper before Jeff takes off on this?
How would you... I know he speaks of the two movements from below upwards and the other movement. And I'm wondering how would you see or articulate the relationship between the two?
One thing that I would say is that consistent fidelity to the creative process is dependent upon the movement from above being continually operative, but both in one's own life and in a community. The moral, his analysis of moral impotence in Insight is brilliant, and that we simply are incapable of sustained development without something I think it's almost always mediated through a loving community that keeps us alive and creative and inquiring and confident and trustful of that we're going to find answers to our questions and so on and so forth. And otherwise, without that, we will not be consistently attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. The biases and the influence of society and a biased culture and so on and so forth will interfere with that, which is why, you know, the educational process is so important in terms of affecting people's students, reaching to their affects, providing a situation. And I don't mean sensitivity groups and that sort of thing, but I just mean providing an environment where there's self-esteem and healthy self-acceptance that's communicated to children and adolescents and so on and so forth, because without that, they just give up. And especially, it's a lot worse today than when I was a kid. The world is so much more complicated today, and we're so much more aware of how difficult it is and how tenuous our hold is on any kind of security, you know, whether it be from within or from outside. And Generation X, you know, they have reasons for despairing. They do. So that would be one part of it, that the movement, that they're all going on at once. Mm-hmm. Progress, decline, redemption is all at once. You know, there's we are intelligent, attentive, reasonable, responsible up to a point. We're biased up to a point. We're graced by God to move beyond our biases. But that's all. It's not like, well, first of all, we make advances, and then we fall back, and then God enters the scene. All three of these are working at the same time. But that would be certainly one of the radical root is the movement from above, you know, that we're socialized into a community. And that's something that is not the result of our own experience, understanding, judgment, and decision, but of the cumulative insights and biases of the people who have brought us into the world and educated us and formed our community and so on. So we all have to, we can't avoid learning from that, and then we reach a point where we realize, well, maybe I've got to call some of this into question. You know, because you can be raised with certain biases, and then you at a certain point you realize, I'm not sure that's right, you know. People are raised in racist environments, and, you know, with God's grace and with luck, they'll get to a point where they question that. But there's, because they've been socialized into something that's very destructive and inauthentic.
When I was reading your work, Subject and Psyche, I was really struck by that semantics of desire that you were speaking about. Because I kind of see an exploration of that as an avenue into, as a way of kind of trying to see how these two movements are related to each other.
Yeah, that's good. I think you're right. I think that's right.
And that's kind of, for me, that's kind of connected with this whole idea of being in love.
And how, oh, yes, definitely.
So...
yes. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that, like, that phrase is Paul Ricoeur's phrase, the semantics of desire, and I think it's in his book on Freud, but it leapt out at me because I thought that, okay, that's what I'm trying to do. What Lonergan's trying to do, and basically is give a, I mean, the desire to know is such an intrinsic thing in insight. Okay, but there is, and then there are the other desires that can interfere with that. Mm-hmm. And then in his later work, that desire to know is really a desire for self-transcendence in all regards, and somehow we know, we're oriented to truth and to the good and ultimately to God, and we will not rest until we see God. But there is so much interference that can come from other desires, and then there's the healing of desire, or the tutoring of desire that comes from. It's also very Ignatian, the affections in the spiritual exercises. The spiritual exercises are all about desire. You know. And then Girard.
Yes.
I mean, he's brought an important element into the analysis of desire, of how much of desire is mimetic and how that can lead to envy, ressentiment, destruction, violence. So, yeah, semantics of desire.
You know, in the Indian philosophical system, the image that they have is to be able to occupy a space of active desirelessness.
Yes.
And somehow, because you are tuned into transcendence, out of that you derive that the commitment of,
yes,
bhakti, the devotion,
yes,
kind of helps you to,
yes,
have some form of differentiation of your desires.
That's
that
right.
Have been historically formed, so that your will does not have to,
that's right,
necessarily kind of follow that.
And that's crucial. It's a crucial thing. I mean, there has, that kind of discipline is, you know, and in the spiritualities of the West and in Christianity, that discipline is there as well. It's, the language may differ on it, but it is there. And, you know, the realities that it reaches may differ, but it's in John of the Cross. The same thing is in John of the Cross, and it's in Ignatius. Or something very similar to that. And not being carried away by inordinate affections, so it's in Ignatius' terminology. At the very beginning, this is the purpose of the spiritual exercises, to learn to live one's life in such a way that one is not carried away by inordinate affections. Well, that's this condition of differentiation of desire.
I'm personally taken in by the importance of a cooperation of theologians and the other disciplines. And I look at the total picture, maybe a bigger picture, of how the church as an institution, well, not necessarily the universal church, but each local church, how each local church could enhance such cooperation. Because what often happens, well, from my own setting, is theologians are in one side,
mm-hmm,
almost irrelevant to society, because they will just be revolving around their own area. And then social scientists are in a different area, and then they do not in any way cooperate at all. And then politicians will capitalize on that and would clash them together, and it will be very difficult to impact or bring about any social change. So I don't know whether we can find out a how-to. I don't know whether a how-to is the best way, but I am kind of taking in a how can that be done?
Well, this is the cutting-edge question, I think, in theology today and in theological method today. I would recommend, if I could, an article in the latest issue of Theological Studies by Neil Ormerod, O-R-M-E-R-O-D. It's a very good article on this whole thing. I mean, it's very good partly because he likes my work, but then and it's really good because he goes into several different approaches that have been taken to the relationship between theology and the social sciences. A very good person is Gibson Winter, and he points out a lot of Winter's study. He points to some shortcomings, but Lonergan was quite taken by Gibson Winter's book, Elements of a Social Ethic, where Winter is talking about Christian ethics and social sciences, the social sciences, and the different. And one of the problems is that we've got four different strands of social science today, at least four. And what Winter tries to do is to show that one strand is okay for studying a certain kind of problem, and another for another, and so on and so forth. But what Ormerod is pointing to is the need for some kind of a general synthesis of these that is theologically influenced in the first place and can support theology by offering general categories to theology. And he quotes a very prominent statement, I think, from the last chapter of Method and Theology, that the church will not become a self-constituting process until theology learns to unite with the other, until theology, which is not the total science of humanity, learns to unite with the other human sciences in cooperation for understanding the world and affecting change in the world. But you've got a lot of people within Christianity, within the different denominations in Christianity, who want nothing to do with that. And we've got John Milbank as the leading person and as the most radical voice, who simply says that all social science is a product of sin and bias, and that the church is the social organization. Little does he know, apparently, that social categories can throw a great deal of light on what's happening in the church, you know, in terms of both authentic and inauthentic uses of power, for instance. Milbank's thing I don't think can possibly survive because it's so extreme that I don't think it will survive at all. And then Ormerod has an earlier article called It's Easy to See, the footnotes of John Milbank, where he pretty well destroys Milbank's scholarly authenticity by showing that Milbank throws in footnotes referring to pages which don't say anything related to what he said in the text and all of this kind of stuff. It's a whole article like this. But anyway, the book, Theology and Social Policy, is that what it's called? Or is Theology? Theology and Social Theory, Milbank's book. I mean, it made me so angry when I started, because he does not take social sciences seriously at all. And theology has no use. I thought it was going to be, how do you bring these together? He doesn't want to bring them together. You know, it's just a total divorce between the two. And it's absurd. Really absurd. Anyway. Okay, I think we better give Jeff a chance to do his thing here. You're on. You are on.
Double-sided handout.
All right.
So I'll be taking up the first two lectures, Religious Experience and Religious Knowledge. These, just to let you know, were delivered at Queen's University here in 1976 under the title Religious Studies and Theology. That's important because what Lonergan is doing in these lectures is looking at how religious studies and theology are distinct and how they might relate. looking at the title of the first lecture, Religious Experience, there are all kinds of interesting things that you could say there about interpreting religious experience, what constitutes it. But his interest is pretty focused here, and that's important. He's taking up the relationship between religious studies, something that is executed by the Department for the Study of Religion here at U of T, the relationship between that and theology, and he's making a proposal. So that's his specific interest. That's what you're going to get from these first two lectures, at least. Now, if you take a look at the handout with this chart, I'd like to ask Professor Doran to quickly remind us which of these functional specialties, the eight that we see here, are carried out by religious studies. We mentioned it in a previous class. I think even someone asked a question about which, did you ask?
Mm-hmm. Well, it would certainly be the first three, research, interpretation, history. When you move into dialectic, you're raising questions, you're at least raising questions that will demand movement out of simply the religious studies.
So that just helps to give you a quick sense of what constitutes religious studies, research, interpretation, and history. Now, I don't have my notes printed as Professor Doran does, so I'm just going to read from my own and occasionally make a reference to this, the second side of the handout. So first, religious experience. Lonergan begins by noting that today, of course, we recognize that knowledge is mediated by symbols, and our actions are also informed by symbols. This is a relatively novel notion of human beings. And he says religious studies, they're interested in these symbols, but religious studies confines its attention to what is within this world. It considers only the things man experiences and not the something more that these symbols point to. Religious symbols are indexical, to use semiotic language. They point to something. Religious studies isn't interested in pursuing what they point to. It's interested in describing them, giving their history, how they relate, but nothing more. Now, Lonergan sees this method of religious studies and its limitations. He sees it as sound. He says that there's a soundness to this. He's not out to dismantle religious studies in any way. But what he quickly turns to in this lecture is the ambiguity of the term experience. We've seen religious studies as bound up with the religious man or woman's experience. Okay, but the term is slightly ambiguous, so he uses this as his way into the lecture. He's going to try to flesh out what experience means. And you'll recall he uses a scientific method to kind of make his point here. And he says, well, look, a scientist experiences some data. And Lonergan gives this the technical term infrastructure. Well, what now? I mean, you've got data. You have to do something with the data. Well, the scientist adds a hypothesis, and that consists in context, problem, discovery, formulation. These are reflective activities. This is more than just data. So we're moving out of infrastructure and into superstructure. But it's interesting, he pursues this superstructure even deeper, you might say. Certainly hypotheses, those are reflective acts on data. But he goes further and he says, earlier even still, a scientist uses technical language to name the data. Well, even that is superstructure. So now we're getting an even greater sense. Even in naming data, you've already moved into superstructure. And you can boil it down even further to the level of ordinary language and common sense knowing that produce the technical language. Even that is superstructure. So really all he's saying is any reflective activity you do on data, it's no longer infrastructure. So what is infrastructure? Well, it's pure experience. That's a very helpful phrase. Pure experience, just data as such. And, of course, for Lonergan, that includes both data of sense and data of consciousness. This is important for some, depending on your philosophical stance, you may not consider data of consciousness. So be preoccupied with the data of sense, with sensing. Okay, so he's given this scientific example to try and clear up what he means by experience and how superstructure is added to it. Now he carries this over into another example, psychology. He says, psychologists recognize that we are conscious of our sensing and feeling, inquiring, and so on. But unless we advert to these activities and give them names, they are infrastructure. Now, notice there that when you're reflecting on experience, it's superstructure, but the experience of yourself reflecting is infrastructure. I hope I'm getting that right. I think it's a somewhat significant distinction to be made here. Infrastructure is experience, but we can say more particularly, it's also experiencing yourself, experiencing yourself, understanding. It's only when you advert to those activities and name them, then you're into superstructure. Okay, so there is a structure to the infrastructure, and that's precisely why he's using that phrase to help us here. And Lonergan gives a final example of what Maslow called a peak experiences. Some people might name what they have as religious experiences, peak experiences. And Lonergan says again, many people have these, but unless you advert to them and reflect on them, they're just infrastructure. Okay, so he's filled out experience somewhat here. And now he's going to pursue more particularly religious experience and how it's cultivated. So this would be reflection on cultivation of. And he begins this section by describing the plasticity of an infant and the shaping, the sort of shaping historical milieu that the infant grows up in. The significance of this passage, in my view at least, is that the infant is born into a ready-made system of symbols that are available. And that's a ready-made superstructure, in a way, if you think about it. And it's supplied to the infant, and we might just name that tradition. A person is born into tradition. It's kind of there for them to accept or reject. So he goes on to say, when we want to cultivate religious experience to bring superstructure to infrastructure, we will no doubt appeal to this language of the tradition that's around us. And he distinguishes stages in the cultivation of religious experience from shamanism, where sort of the whole of living is sacred, to the more compartmentalized view of the ascetic schools. So you can see how the tradition a person is born into is going to give them different tools to cultivate their religious experience. Lonergan says you've got a lot of change going on here, but what's consistent amidst this change in traditions and in ways of cultivating, what's consistent is authenticity, both of the individual appropriating the tradition that he's born into or she is born into, and the authenticity of the tradition itself. So you've got two levels there, major and minor authenticity. He takes this up further in Method and Theology. The major is, make sure I'm getting this correct, I think the minor is the major of the tradition itself, yep. So that's the wider, the authenticity within the tradition. and the minor is me encountering it, appropriating it, saying, you know, does this offer the tools that I need to make use of myself, interpret my experience, or does it not offer those tools? So tradition isn't something, Lonergan says, tradition isn't something that can be done away with. Rather, you know, the focus here is the struggle between authenticity and inauthenticity. He will describe that more shortly. Now, notice that unauthenticity, I have to be careful about that. It's not, the second term there is unauthenticity, which is not recognized by Microsoft Word. So if you're writing an essay on this, be careful. It's going to automatically make it inauthenticity, but for Lonergan, it's un, which is important. It's the opposite, the undoing almost of authenticity. Notice that this is dialectical. Religious studies is only interested in describing the rituals and symbols of a religion and its history, as we saw with this chart, and it stops here. So this authenticity struggle against unauthenticity is not a concern for religious studies. So here we have the first important way in which they're distinct. Again, religious studies isn't to be done away with, and you see that really by looking at Lonergan's functional specialties. He's got these specialties here, but theology is going to add to this, and we'll see shortly how it adds to it. Okay, if it's okay, I'd like to continue on. I'm almost done, and then we can discuss the material. Okay, in the next section, Lonergan moves into what he calls the immanent context of religious experience. And here he is shifting from religious studies to theology, from simply being involved with religious symbols to having those symbols move us beyond ourselves. You can see authenticity is bubbling here underneath what he's talking about. It's coming up. Moving beyond ourselves to the world, and then he says to the neighbor, then he says to the stars. Well, you could say the heavens or the ultimate. So the symbols carry us beyond ourselves, and they do so to different degrees. Some people might stay at the level of love of neighbor. Others might engage in some kind of nationalism and assist their country. And others will dedicate themselves to the ultimate. Now, Lonergan links this with W.C. Smith's rather famous notion of inner commitment. While Lonergan will ultimately disagree with a large part of Smith's project, namely the idea that, just trying to remember my Smith here, I think Smith names religious experience faith, whereas Lonergan makes a distinction between religious experience and faith as a cognitive aspect of that. In short, there's less differentiation within Smith than I think Lonergan would like. And Smith also might be said to focus too much on the trust aspect of faith and sort of prescind from the propositional. So there may be denominational sort of influences operating there. But what Lonergan does like from Smith is this notion of inner commitment. Well, what is it? Lonergan says it's the opposite of drifting. It's very interesting. That is, drifting is simply doing what others do, saying what others say. If you think about it, being born into a tradition and just accepting it. Inner commitment is the opposite of that. And Lonergan says, out of that company of drifters, which unfortunately it does tend to be a rather large group because it is easy, there emerges a group of individuals who, quote, face the problem of personal existence. Here comes authenticity again. If you think about that phrase, the problem of personal existence, you immediately come to think of self-possession and self-appropriation. I exist, I'm a person, what am I going to do about it? I mean, that's all the problem of personal existence is about, is reflecting on being a person. And Lonergan expresses the effect of facing up to this personal existence quite beautifully on page 123. So I think we should quickly look to the original text here. So it's the final full paragraph on 123. It starts with, commonly such a discovery. And maybe rather than hearing me, if anyone is interested, they could read it. Okay. Anybody really, really eager to? Okay. So commonly such a discovery, that is, the discovery of the problem of personal existence, such a decision, such a program of self-actualization becomes effective and irrevocable when one falls in love. Then one's being becomes being in love. Such being in love is not without its antecedents, its causes, its conditions, and occasions. But once it has blossomed forth, and as long as it lasts, it takes over. It becomes the imminent and effective first principle. From it flows one's desires and fears, one's joys and sorrows, discernment of values, day-to-day decisions and deeds. I think that last one is maybe the most important. Day-to-day decisions and deeds are informed by this being in love, by this religious experience that's there, and if you reflect on it and appropriate yourself, there's going to be this outflowing. So this outflowing, as Lonergan has said, is reflected in love of spouse, even more in love of country, and ultimately love of God. And as Lonergan often does, he cites Romans 5:5, St. Paul speaking of God's love flooding our inmost heart through the Holy Spirit he has given us. Okay, so wrapping up, Lonergan goes on to explain how religious experience fits into human consciousness. He says, like voices in a symphony, religious experience can stand out strongly as a really strong voice, or it may just resonate faintly. And like a kind of musical motif, it may recur or it may not recur. He interestingly uses these three stages of in the inner life, a tradition that I'm unfamiliar with, but he uses that to sort of give the stages of the development of this religious voice, this being in love, the way it speaks in this sort of symphony of other concerns. One begins by trying to simply eliminate the conflict between their religious commitment, their being in love with God, and other themes recurrent in consciousness. So, like a symphony, you're trying to separate out and isolate this voice that's propelling you towards self-transcendence. And ultimately, in the final stage of this, these stages that he delineates, ultimately you move towards the unitive goal of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, fidelity, gentleness, and self-control, the fruits of the Spirit. It's Galatians 5:22, another verse Lonergan cites often. Now, I realize we're just reached 3 o'clock.
Why don't you finish what you want to say about okay. this piece, and then we'll take a break.
I'd say it'd just take me another 2 minutes to wrap up.
Fine.
Okay, I'd like to turn to the second side of that handout and take a look at the section religion. Now, these are from the Lonergan website, it has an interesting glossary of Lonergan, Lonerganian terms, terminology. And I find it helpful sometimes to flesh out Lonergan's own thought. Now again, I mean, this is coming from outside of the text, so take this with a grain of salt. But I'd like to read this, because I think it it says a few things which maybe Lonergan doesn't say in this lecture, but you might be sort of wishing to hear. And we've heard a lot about religious experience. Well, here the editors of this glossary give us a definition of religion according to Lonergan. So as it says, as he's wont to do, he gives us a functional definition. Religion is the capacity of human consciousness to apprehend ultimate meaning and ultimate value symbolically. Well, we saw that today in our readings, from spouse to nation to ultimate and symbolic throughout. In contrast, theology questions this apprehension. So it questions the apprehension of being in love, and it mediates between religion and the role of religion in a cultural matrix. Lonergan opens Method and Theology with that. Religious studies, a third term, remember that in this lecture he started out reflecting on religious studies. This third term is the historical study of religions. So there's a neat example here. Theology is to religion what economics is to business, or biology is to health. So the function of religion then is to provide a worldview within which one might live intelligently, reasonably, and responsibly. And theology endeavors to discern whether there is any real fire behind the smoke of symbols employed in this or that religion. I really like that, because it shows you the flux of symbols, but there's some causality behind them. And that's the task of theology, is discerning if there's a cause genuinely interpreted behind these symbols. And this concludes here, the responsibility prompted by religion includes not only morality, but the total commitment that authentic religion prompts. So this is really quite a novel delineation of, or a separation of these three tasks. And when Lonergan concludes his lecture, he links religious development and cognitive development. And he says, the sense of development from above downwards, this enveloping worldview, remember, being in love flows into one's day-to-day decisions and deeds. So this above-downwards enveloping worldview is, he hints, intimates, that it's really what religious studies is lacking. There's the difference. So I'll stop there.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And I think what we will do is break, and then we'll come back, and depending on what Jeff wants to do, whether you want to go on to the next one first and then discuss, whatever is more comfortable for you.
If people have questions, get them out there. Let's do it. Otherwise, I'm prepared to go on.
Okay, we'll get the questions out first. I've just reminded one thing that I want to say, which I always found humorous, is that when in Method and Theology, at least some of the times when Lonergan quotes Galatians 5:22, he omits patience. And anybody that knew Lonergan is always ready to say that might be a Freudian. Okay, let's break for a 10. And,
I just have a quick housekeeping thing.
Yeah.
Could we email your notes to us? I would appreciate having your synthesis.
Or I can bring copies in the following week for others.
Well, you can email it and then.
Whatever is easier for you. Whichever way is easier for you. But it would be nice to have it.
Okay. Yeah. I'll make them available. Okay. Yep.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.